This is Carol Foster of 2 Timothy 2:15 Resources, and I am so excited that you're going to join me today as we study God's Word. The response new Messianic believers give when asked why they initially visited a Messianic congregation is, "We knew there had to be more." As we study together, we will begin to see that yes, indeed, there has to be more. For additional study aids to assist you in studying along with us, go to our website, sectim.org. I am so glad that you're joining us today as we continue our study of the second of our main topics in the book of Bereshit, which is titled Elohim's Curse on the Violation of His Creation. Again, this major topic spans chapter 3, verse 1, through chapter 7, verse 24. We're currently in the subsection that I've titled Secondary Recipients, the Creation Destroyed by the Flood. This specifically covers chapter 4, verse 1, through chapter 7, verse 24. The last time that we met, we had discovered that the biblical setting of the beginning of Bereshit, or Genesis chapter 4, is worship, and the factor that led to Abel's death was Cain's exaggerated pride. Like his parents before him, Cain desired recognition that did not rightly belong to him, as we read in Bereshit chapter 4, verse 7. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain told Abel his brother, "And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him." The fighting between the godly and the ungodly lines that were born of the woman was manifested when Cain murdered Abel. The apostle Yochanan, or John, later caused Cain to typify those who murder and show hatred toward the righteous, as we read in 1 Yochanan, or 1 John, chapter 3, verse 12. "For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one, and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil, and his brother's were righteous." We discovered that the relationship between Cain and the brother Abel impacted the relationship Cain had with Jehovah. Bereshit chapter 4, verses 1 through 16, makes it clear to sever the tie with one's sibling is to sever one's tie with Jehovah and the earth. From the genealogy of Cain that we previously read, Bereshit shows that human ruthlessness pervades a culture that lives outside the presence of the Lord. We also learn from this incident in Adam's early heritage how sin has its sway over the human family, as we see its expansion from the self-serving choices of Adam and Eve in the garden to the ruthless killing of one brother by another outside Eden. Jehovah's response of a curse against Cain underscores the accountability of any person who would dare to tamper with the sacredness of human life, which exclusively bears the image of Elohim. The ground already had been cursed by Jehovah. Then Cain was cursed from the ground that had soaked up Abel's blood, revealing that Jehovah still held sovereign right and protection over life. Today we'll see that pride continues to dominate Cain's lineage and is revisited among the men of renown in Noah's day and the later builders of Babel's Tower. Structurally, the Cain-Abel narrative is sandwiched between two sections recounting the birth and genealogy of Adam's eldest, Cain. Cain's genealogy ends, as we read, in the Song of Lamech, or the Song of the Sword, in which Lamech boasts of his infamous career. This is followed by the announcement of Seth's birth and a brief genealogical statement, concluding this section with a note about worship of the Lord. The genealogies of Bereshit were designed to show both the multiplication of evil in the world and Jehovah's plan of redemption. As we read on, we discover that the line from Cain through Lamech shows the spread of murderers. Remarkably, however, the grace of Jehovah toward Cain did enable Adam's firstborn to survive, and later to father an impressive lineage whose members are remembered for notable cultural achievements. Unfortunately, these achievements were overshadowed by their wicked accomplishments, as we read in verses 17 through 24 of this same chapter. Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived, and gave birth to Enoch, and he built a city, and called the name of the city Enoch, after the name of his son. Now to Enoch was born Irad, and Irad became the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael became the father of Methushael, and Methushael became the father of Lamech. Lamech took himself two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of those who play the lyre and the pipe. As for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron, and the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me, and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. These two last verses of this passage is known as Lamech's poem, or the so-called Song of the Sword. In these verses, he boasts before his wives about his prowess as a combatant, and he revels in the glory of his victims. This indicates that violence encircles Cain's lineage, as we see in Lamech's claim that he is provoked by another who injured him. Although no weapon such as a sword is stated in the poem, Tubal-Cain's industry of forging metal objects implies weaponry that in the hands of evil men resulted in escalating violence. Lamech thinks himself invincible with his newly acquired weapons as he asserts his domination over anyone who might trouble him. Lamech's gloating over a reputation more ruthless and infamous than Cain's shows the disparagement of human life among Cain's seed that was fostered by his murder of Abel. Jehovah's promise to avenge Cain's life seven times is interpreted by Lamech as a badge of honor for Cain, rather than a merciful provision by Jehovah for a shameful criminal. Lamech contends that if Cain's value is reprised seven times, then his acclaimed deeds merit much more. This also fits the first context, which serves as a warning against any who would seek vengeance against Cain. Lamech's boast, therefore, has the same related message for any future avenger. But in Cain's case, it is Jehovah who pronounces vengeance. Here, Lamech, in his twisted logic, may presume upon divine protection. Or he may imply in a sarcastic tone his lack of need for it. This is the first recorded incident in the Bible where crime is venerated by the culprit. As we continue to read in verse 25 of chapter 4, we read that Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son, and named him Seth, for she said, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. The birth of Seth is interpreted by Eve as Elohim's response to the loss of righteous Abel. By bearing again, the hope of another seed born to Eve meant a righteous lineage is possible through Adam's son, Seth. Abel was dead, and Cain was disqualified. As in the case of naming Cain, Eve explains theologically the choice of Seth's name. The Hebrew name Seth is related by sound and is pronounced Set, if not originally, to the Hebrew word for granted, pronounced Sat. Eve attributes the birth of the child to the mercy of Jehovah, who has provided her a third son. It would seem that the first round is won by the serpent in the murder of righteous Abel, but the gift of Seth ensures that the promise will stay alive through Eve, who is found, after all, to be the mother of all living. It's interesting to note that as we've been reading, the usage of the name of God as Elohim has now changed in the original text to Jehovah. Now, in these verses, we read that the narrator has reverted back to God being addressed as Elohim, or the Creator. We see that his name as Jehovah was used as he dealt with HaSatan, where it was found in the setting of deception and distrust. But now the use of his name as Jehovah appears to be Eve's deliberate, though late, response to the serpent's cynicism toward Elohim's goodness. Seth, Adam's third son, replaces the murdered Abel and heads a new lineage that is remembered as the benchmark for when men began to call on the name of the Lord. Eden held for the man and woman a blissful communion with Elohim without mediation. When life outside the garden is first regarded by the narrative, Cain and Abel are depicted at worship, presenting offerings before Adonai, the Lord. This early incident shows what is acceptable worship in the eyes of Jehovah. The customs of Moshe and his followers took the matter of worship very seriously, with its emphasis on the time, place, and means. Consequently, the Cain-Abel narrative held more importance for the ancient reader than it does in most of our churches today. It is this example of bringing the best, and our best, to Jehovah in worship that is overlooked by many believers in Yeshua today. Remember that according to Bereshit chapter 4, verses 3 and 5, we read that in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground, Abel, on his part, also brought the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. The Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. Abel brought the firstlings of his flock and the best portion, their fat portions, while Cain just brought fruit of the ground. And the text does not say if it was the first or the best of his crop. The initial question in this chapter is why Abel's offering was accepted and not Cain's. However, the larger issue is that of what will become the promised blessing and deliverance. We next read the beginning of the genealogy of Seth, Adam and Eve's third son, in Bereshit chapter 4, verse 26. To Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Although worship through offerings was practiced by Cain and Abel, as we read previously, this verse announces a new direction in formal worship, as in Abram's building of an altar upon arriving in Canaan, where the same descriptive phrase, called on the name of the Lord, occurs. By inaugurating altar worship in Canaan, a historic significance for the family of faith occurred. Even so, worship at the birth of Enosh was not new to the family of Adam, and the name Jehovah had already been spoken by Eve. Called on the name of the Lord in this subsection unites the Lord of the patriarchs and of Moshe with the Lord of the ancient line of promise through Seth. By doing so, this shows that the spiritual ancestors of Abraham's family were those descended through Noah, the survivor of the flood's purge, as we'll discover as we continue our study. Whereas Cain was alienated from the Lord's presence, the clan descended from Seth practiced and declared the word of the Lord. The account infers that Cain's family perished altogether in the catastrophic flood, but the tiny remnant of Seth's lineage emerged from the ark to perpetuate its spiritual birthright. This then offers at last a bright spot among the dim accounts of sin and death that have dominated the garden story. There is yet hope for sinful humanity. I find it really interesting, as we continue our study, that the first verse of chapter 5 alludes to a written account of creation. The New American Standard translates this verse as, "This is the book of the generation of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God." While the New International Version translates it as, "This is the written account of Adam's line, when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. This account differs from all others in and outside Bereshit by the descriptive word written or book, specifying that the author had used a written source. It's reasonable to surmise that other genealogies occurring in Bereshit were also recorded resources available to the author, whom we understand to be Moshe, or Moses. This may also have been understood as oral history. The Tanakh, or the Old Testament, elsewhere acknowledges the presence of other ancient books. We find the Book of Wars of the Lord in Bamidbar, or Numbers 21:24. Therefore, it is said in the Book of the Wars of the Lord. And we see the Book of Jasher mentioned in Yahashua, or Joshua, chapter 10, verse 13. So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, while the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the Book of Jasher? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And again in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 17 and 18, Then David chanted with his lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the new song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. It is sufficient to say that chapter 5, verse 1 of Bereshit refers to a written document without recommending that it's part of an encompassing book of genealogies. The purpose of the genealogy found in chapter 5 was to show the development of the human family from Adam through Noah, and to illustrate the falsity of Hasatan's claim, "You won't die." Some have used the Bible's genealogy in an attempt to reconstruct a chronological record back to creation. On this basis, James Usher, born in 1581 and died in 1656, dated creation at 4004 B.C. However, the problem with such efforts is that biblical genealogies were not intended to present a full chronology, but to trace a family line back to a chief ancestor. Following the introduction, the genealogy proper traces the ancestral lineage from Adam, the first to bear the image of Elohim, to the flood survivor, Noah. The consistency and continuity of the family indicates that uninterrupted succession of the divine image passed down by generation to generation from father to son. Within the passage, we note that there is spotlighted several individuals, Adam, Enoch, Lamech, and Noah. After Adam, in verses 3 through 5, there are 9 sons listed, and in each case, except Enoch, Lamech, and Noah, the same account information is followed, identifying the age of the individual patriarch when he fathers his firstborn son, second, the remaining years of his life, third, the acknowledgement of other sons and daughters, four, the total years of his life, and five, the notice of his death. Each patriarch's greatest contribution is his role in effecting the promised blessing through the birth of a descendant. This is each patriarch's portion in Jehovah's charitable plan for the human family. Nevertheless, no one achieves the full realization of the blessing since death continues to reign. This is true even for the righteous Enoch, whose son Methuselah also dies, having inherited the sentence of death. I did find something interesting in my study of this chapter of seemingly innocuous genealogies. If we read closely, all of the father's introductions begin with the name, followed by the word lived. An example is found in verse 28, Lamech lived. Again, this is the pattern seen throughout this chapter. Then, in verse 32, as it introduces Noah differently, it reads, Noah was. Why did the author change the introduction of this account? It may have been to distinguish Noah as another beginning. The sages suggest to us, as found in the Humash, that Noah, after the flood, that the earth no longer produced thorns and thistles when one planted wheat. The curse of the ground had been removed with the flood. The final verse, verse 32 of chapter 5, reads, Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Of Noah's son, Shem is most likely the eldest, based on the agreements of chapter 5 and chapter 11, verses 10 through 26, which cite the firstborn son for each generation. The origin of the name Shem is uncertain. In Hebrew, Shem means name. Perhaps the name for his firstborn reflects Noah's aspirations for his son to attain a reputation or a name for himself. If so, it is realized in a way that Noah could not have imagined. Shem's lineage dominates the period after the flood in the writings of the author of Bereshit, since he's the ancestor of the Hebrews by his son Eber, as we can read in chapter 10, verse 21, and the forefather of Abraham, as found in chapter 10, verses 21 through 31, and in chapter 11, verses 10 through 26. We also discover that he is his father's favored son, as stated in chapter 9, verses 26 and 27. Ham is the youngest of Noah's three sons, and the origin of the name Ham is uncertain, but some attribute it to the native term for Egypt, Cana, which meant the black land, in reference to the soil of Egypt. We also find that Ham is synonymous with Egypt in select psalms, such as found in Tehillim, or Psalms 105, verse 23. Israel also came into Egypt, thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. Ham, on the other hand, through his son Canaan, becomes the disgraced son in his father's household, as we can read in Bereshit chapter 9. We also note that Canaan became the ancestor of many of Israel's traditional enemies, as is stated in chapter 10, verses 6 through 20, which include the Cushites, the Amorites, the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Jebusites, the Girgashites, and the Hivites. Again, according to these verses, all of these tribes were descendants of Ham through his son Canaan. The youngest son of Noah is Japheth, and we read very little about him in the biblical account. However, the name Japheth is related to the Hebrew word Yefet, or to extend, at least as the source of sound play, where Noah prays that God will enlarge his, Japheth's, territory under the patronage of Shem. We see this in Bereshit 9, verses 25 through 27, as Noah makes his prophetic statement over his three sons, after the incident of uncovering his nakedness. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." The study of these three sons, where they settled, who their descendants were, and how they impacted the history of ancient Israel, and how their descendants continue to interact with the world today, is fascinating. Just a thought for another study. If you've missed any of our previous sessions in this study, you can go to www.HebrewNation.Torah Study. There has to be more. And listen to any previous sessions or any of the other studies that we've done on this program. Also, I've downloaded free PDF study aids for this study, including a map of where the descendants of the three sons of Noah eventually settled. I think you'll be surprised when you see how this now impacts our world today. These and other study aids for your use can be found on my website, www.sectim.org. You can also subscribe to Hebrew Nation Radio, Torah Studies, for additional programs presented by different hosts. Again, thank you for joining us today on There Has to Be More. Thank you for joining us today as we delve into the beautiful truths of God's Word to indeed discover that there has to be more. I pray that the Word applied to your daily life will bring a deeper understanding of His love letter written just to you. Let me remind you that we have additional study aids to assist you with our studies together on our website, That's secTIM.org. May this day fill you with the love of God, joy, and shalom. Nothing missing, nothing broken in your life.